I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. I spent this past weekend house sitting for friends who live out in the country. It's a great escape from the noisy, bright city where you can see stars. There are hummingbirds, quail, rabbit on their property. I took a couple of six-mile walks past rolling hills of new crops and an old-fashioned windmill and enjoyed a conversation with a woman training her horse. But I wouldn't necessarily want to live out there. I'm still searching for the place where I'd really like to dig in. I've lived in the foothills, and I've lived near the ocean. I'm looking for a balanced location of flowing water access and convenience of a city. Sometimes, in my meandering thoughts of homes, I think of those who have lost theirs due to financial situations, natural disasters, or other circumstances. Some still struggle, and others have managed to literally move ahead. From the fortunate ones on the upswing, Sally Ooms collected stories for her book, Finding Home, How Americans Prevail, to inspire others who have lost their homes. So I love the quote at the beginning of the book by Maya Angelou. The ache for home lives in all of us, the safe place where we can go as we are and not be questioned. How many homeowners did you speak to for this book?
The book really goes beyond the physicality of homeowners. And so I probably spoke to about 75 different people. And I started off with victims of natural disasters because that's what I was particularly interested in that type of displacement. As a journalist, I'd done lots of articles on displacement. But then it became very apparent that it isn't just the rebuilding of the home, it is what does home mean in a deeper sense. And it means so many different things to so many different people. And people find it strictly in their hearts, in their heads, somewhere inside of themselves is basically what it kind of boils down to when you're talking about it. That place where they go, they're authentic, and they find their strength to rebuild, to carry on, to surmount problems. Yeah, and so the answer to your question is probably 75 people or so, and then I narrowed it down to about 50 with different groupings. I started out interviewing former foster kids who had been tossed around, obviously, from lots of times they are place to place. And then I found out what they did to recreate a sense of home in their lives. And what was very important for them was a family. And even if they've had dreadful parents or a parent who raised them, they were really determined to be good parents themselves. And sometimes some of them adopted their siblings. Then I also talked with combat veterans and talked to them about how they found their center again. Particularly the ones with PTSD had problems feeling comfortable with that sense of home that they had once had. I talked to people who were making that big decision whether to, in retirement, whether to go to a retirement home or not. That's a big decision at the end of life, and these were Iowans for the most part, very independent types of people. Then I talked to immigrants who always have that desire to start anew, but also bring with them vestiges, at least, of their culture, and that means home to them. It's just everything from dance to music, food, and that's only natural. So I also talked with Navajo women who are trying to improve their homeland areas, and I spoke with homeless people. Then the two, I'd call them ex-victims of natural disasters because they don't act like victims anymore, were from Katrina, but I centered in on Mississippi more so because New Orleans really got a lot of attention, and the people in Mississippi, particularly Biloxi, were very devastated. And then I talked to people in Greensburg, Kansas, and they came up with some really creative solutions. Their whole town of 2,400 people all the houses were wiped out. They lost very few lives, luckily, because they pretty much have good warning systems there. But they decided that they were going to build green. So they have created a little micro center for how you can deal with high winds, how you can, their entire town is powered by wind generators. It's just a marvelous thing to see, this little town in the middle of Kansas. And so they really found a creative solution, put themselves on the map, because they had a lot of people who were elderly or older, and their young people had kind of moved away to cities. So it wasn't so much a farming community anymore. It was maybe farmers who had retired and were living in this little town. But now they have people moving back because it's such an exciting place to try out all this new stuff. And they're on the crest of the wave. It's great. There's something to see. Then I had a few people who had found home in their professions, which I think is not unheard of. I think particularly for men very often. And they were redefining home. They were deciding that they'd come off center in their lives and they wanted to reestablish something that really felt like them, meant something to them. I talked to a woman who, a formerly battered woman. She told me about what her life had been. And I talked to a woman who had been foreclosed on more than once, and even before the terrible crisis. Then a man in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who has this program and says if you follow his program, you aren't going to be likely to be foreclosed on. I had a combination. But the thing to know is that most of the stories in the book are upbeat. I caught people on the upswing. I really didn't want to put together a book, oh, poor me, I lost my home, you know, what am I ever going to do? Because we get enough of that on the news, thank you very much. And it's kind of not followed up on. What do people do then? And people are just amazing. Americans, and that's why I have how Americans prevail. I love that word prevail.
There are those that wherever they hang their hat is
that's
their
right, absolutely.
And they find that when they've lost their physical home. That they realize, you know, I kind of like not being stuck to one place.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
nice to have a home base, maybe.
Yeah.
Or a place to
yeah.
keep your stuff.
Yes.
But it's not home. It's just a...
Yes, there are. I mean, I know a person in San Francisco who runs this clinic where they are trying to keep homeless people from utilizing the San Francisco General so much for emergency. So she's developed a whole program around these people. And there are people, for the most part, she says she's really never run into anybody who didn't want a home. She works mostly with men, although she does know some who she goes and visits who live under bushes. She knows which bush.
Well, I wasn't talking about the homeless people. I was speaking
oh,
about
okay.
those that have like a gypsy spirit.
A gypsy spirit,
but
absolutely.
They've never had a chance
too.
To answer the call, so to speak, until
yes.
they no longer had a physical
yes.
home. And it
yes.
was a sudden conscious realization that
yeah.
they weren't meant to stay in one place.
Yes.
That they travel and visit villages and
might
small
be
towns.
Be a little
and
bit
cities
like that
and
myself.
I've had little glimpses of it.
Have you?
Yes. So that's why I like the concept of this book, that
yeah.
home means something different to everyone.
Yeah.
Home for you could be visiting old and new friends and family around the globe.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, your ages, you're talking about foster children, so what are approximate ages that you talk to us?
Oh, gosh. I think the youngest person I talked to was 16, and the oldest person I talked to was 98, and she has passed on now.
Well, tell me about her. What was
yeah.
her name?
Oh, yeah, her name was Betty, and she was one of the ones who was determined that she was not going to leave her home, and it was a big old house. And, of course, her sister lived next door, so that was fortuitous because she could look after her and she was in better health, really. And Betty fell down the stairs going to the laundry down in their basement. I mean, the bruises, she'd go to the doctor and he'd say, well, come on now. He said, look, you're either going to have to move to a place or I'm going to put a pacemaker in. She said, well, let's go for the pacemaker. And her grandchildren loved to come to this old house in Iowa. And her father had built it. It was just so deeply embedded in who she was that I was glad that she was able to stay in her house. And not everybody's so lucky. In fact, lots of people aren't. It's a shame because that move sometimes is so devastating for people. Yeah.
So which of the stories surprised you a little bit? at the decisions that they made as a result of their particular situation. That it was a door maybe you personally would not have chosen, but it was absolutely perfect and appropriate for them.
There was a man probably in his 30s who was, I think, a sous chef in San Francisco. And he was commuting from Antioch, which is, what, a good 80 miles probably? Then he decided he had to live in San Francisco and got an apartment. And he just couldn't cover it. And his wife, ex-wife, and daughter, who was in her teenage years, said, we need a place to live. And so he said, here, you take the apartment. I can make it out on the streets. Now, I mean, that's a strange decision to me. And, you know, go to work. I mean, where do you find a place to clean up before you go and you be the sous chef, right? And truth to tell, it really didn't work out for him. He got everything stolen, for one thing. He didn't know how to protect his stuff, and so his backpack, his shoes at one point. But the backpack, with all his ID and everything, was just a devastating thing. So he decided, well, he would come to Sacramento because he had heard that there were better services and that he could work his way up and out of what was homelessness at this point. So he got on BART, I believe, and then he was going to take a train to Sacramento and or a bus or something, and he couldn't get on any of those things because he didn't have ID. So he ended up walking to Sacramento, and there's a tale, I'll tell you. But his spirit was just incredible. And he walked mainly through rural areas, of course, and he said, I didn't want to do it, but every once in a while I'd pick an apple or a piece of fruit or a tomato or something, and he found a hose in somebody's backyard, and he drank water, and on he went. And when he got to Sacramento, then the homeless contingency here said, oh, yeah, this is what you do. These are the steps you take. He was waiting to get a cell phone because a phone is a really important thing. You can't have prospective employers calling you at shelter. They won't hire you. Just a fascinating tale. But I think, my gosh, just making myself homeless suddenly. It's
by choice?
Yes, by choice. Oh, my gosh. So that was one.
So how were you able to organize the book? Do you have certain categories kind of?
Yeah, I did do it to former foster kids, soldiers, ex-soldiers at that point, the retirement. I have one where I put the Navajo women in with, because I think it's all women, and so people who are overcoming great odds as women.
Well, tell me about the Navajo.
They all were very interesting women, but Louise Yellowstone was probably the most interesting to me. It's funny because I went there, and what I was going to do was do interviews around a water issue. After having been run over and the mining that came in and the plutonium, the uranium that they endured, all that on their land, and there's something called the Bennett Freeze where the government froze a huge area of the Navajo Nation and they couldn't do any improvements for 40 years. I mean, just on and on and on. I thought, now they're going to take this water away from people. So I went to talk to them just because I thought, well, you can't even live in homes if you don't have water. You don't have a water source. And the man who was at the head of this tribal thrust, I guess, to right the government and get things going, sort of an activist, was having meetings, and I was allowed to sit in on the meetings, but the meetings were all in Navajo. And then he would introduce me, and he would tell, presumably, what I was doing with my book. And then you'd see people nod, oh, that's nice. And then I'd just sit through the meeting, and then I'd go to another one. And there was one where they took me out. I was glad that I'd rented a really good four-wheel drive. There were no roads. It was just sand. But I saw what they were up against because they took me probably 20 miles on this sand overhill and overdale. And then we came to one of the chapter houses in the middle of nowhere. And here was the Navajo meeting again, but they were having food, and it was sort of a little festival, and they started talking about the difficulties of water. They had to go once a week, I think it was. They had to travel over these roads to go where someone had a pickup truck that had barrels and they could get just so much water. It was just unbelievable. Well, anyway, I never did get to interview him. the last meeting that I attended, this is about 5 days over how long I planned to be on my trip. So he said to himself, we're kind of working on Navajo time here. He said, you know, you should talk to my mother. And I thought that I was sort of being foisted off. I said, okay, well, that's fine. I'll talk to your mother. Well, she turned out to be the most powerful woman, one of the most powerful women I've ever met in my life. She started out as a child, I think until she was 14, she was a sheep herder in this really, really remote area. And, I mean, I won't tell her whole story, but she ended up being on the county council in Flagstaff, representing her people for 30 years. So she came from a position of not even knowing how to speak or write English, educating herself, and stages, she became this very powerful woman and got a lot done for the Navajo people.
So how was the water resolved, or was the issue resolved at all?
These people are on the kind of western outreach of the Navajo Nation, and so lots happens in the eastern part, and they have a hard time connecting with them. But I think that the Navajo government has finally overcome that issue so that they're not going to be able to take water from that western section because there's so little water to take. And in this day and age, we're really keeping a watchful eye on that.
Of course, the natural disasters, as you mentioned, Katrina, and there's flooding. And, Mother Nature has a long list that she can refer to
absolutely,
when she wants to cause some trouble for people.
One of the things that was interesting about that is when I went to Louisiana and East Biloxi to interview people who had rebuilt, so many people said, well, what right do they have to be living there? They shouldn't be living in an area where that happens so often. And I thought, now if that were your home, you would definitely have a different viewpoint.
Well, I think that the common perspective is that we have to pay for it. You're living in a place where Mississippi regularly floods, and you continue to put your house there.
Yes.
Well, that's fine. That's your option, your life, until I have to pay for it. So I think that's what the issue is, that people...
That's part of the issue, but I did notice that just at the time I was publishing the book, Hurricane Sandy happened. In fact, the guy who did the cover in New York had lost everything in Sandy. And so I thought that was kind of symbolic. Here is my designer out of a home and a business. But Sandy turned people's heads around. That was a really populated area, and they started thinking, this could happen to us too.
But I'm talking about places that have patterns.
Yes,
repeatedly.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed
that's
to
right.
periodic, Sandy's not an ongoing pattern.
But I mean, every place has.
But again, I have no issue with people living wherever they want.
Yes,
if they like living on the edge.
That's
go
right.
for it.
That's right.
I just don't want to have to pay for it.
Okay,
if
but
something comes
you could say that San Franciscans are living on the edge.
Well,
you
with Sandy, I don't think there's an edge. I think it's just a sandy pit.
there's
no edge to it.
Speaking of Sandy,
you've had quite a few homes over the years.
I have.
Is that by choice for career, or you just need a change of place, or all the above?
Married. When I first was married, I went to Spain with my now ex-husband. So we lived there a couple of years and traveled around. And then when we came back, he wanted to become a cabinet maker, and so we went to Oregon. And some of my movement has been because of mates, and some of it has been because I needed a job in some other place. And I'm very, very attracted to physically beautiful places and views.
That is so odd.
Yes, isn't it? So that's taken me, I've had good luck with that. That's taken me several places. And I think now I have a mate who is pretty much filled with wanderlust as well.
I'm assuming that having lived in different locales and different types of homes, you can relate to a lot of the stories on what they've lost and what they're trying to rebuild.
Yeah.
You know, you've been in places where maybe you weren't receiving the services that you needed, or the neighborhood maybe isn't the best, but that's where you had to be for a certain period of time.
And absolutely.
That makes you a better listener. It makes the people who've experienced these situations to be more open with you in sharing, because they know you've been there.
People do seem to trust me with their stories. I'm
and your
very
journalistic
grateful.
Background probably helps as well,
too. That can go either way sometimes. Every person, because these are first-person accounts, I let them proof their stories. And that's frankly where I lost a few people, because I'd started writing them in third person. I had started writing them as articles. I'm a journalist, right? But when I moved to San Francisco to publish the book, then my editor there said, these really should be coming right from them. And I said, oh gosh, that's going to take some backpedaling, but I can do it. I can do it. And I really am glad I did, because it gives you an immediacy.
Yeah, they're talking to the reader.
Yeah. And they're different voices. Yeah.
So what's your next project? Where is it taking you? Speaking of trips and relocating, yes. Albeit temporarily.
Yeah. Well, I lived in the little Chinese town of Lock, California, when it's in the Sacramento River Delta. And I lived there in the 70s and early 80s. There were a lot of the Chinese descendants still alive. Now it is pretty much a place where that we are memorializing the Chinese there. But I'm speaking with several of their descendants, sort of their sons, daughters, grandkids, about people who could connect me with the Chinese, the original Chinese who came and built the levees. People all came from the Pearl River Delta, and they knew how to build the levees. That's why they still had a use. They had been working on the railroad, and the railroad was done. But the people in the Delta said that they wanted to reclaim this land, and they came and did that. And then afterwards, they knew how to farm, so they stayed there and they farmed. But Lock is the only rural Chinese town in the United States that Chinese built for themselves, rather than a Chinatown. You go over here, this is where you live. So it is truly their town. That's unique. And I really want to connect with the descendants of those people in the Pearl River Delta and make some connections. And so that's the gist. It's still percolating, but that's the gist. And I am going to go to China in probably September.
In what area of China?
The Pearl River Delta. It's Guangdong. And it's going to be a little bit of a challenge because Guangdong is the most populated province in China. Some of the villages have probably been swallowed up a bit, but I have some help from people who grew up there. It's really exciting.
Could you read a little bit from your book?
Yeah, I'll just tell you a little bit about Priscilla. She's a former foster kid, and she was in her mid-20s when I interviewed her. Lived in a little humble house in San Diego County. It had one bedroom, and when I came in, she and her sister, whom she had adopted, were living in the living room. And then her grandfather, who I believe was 98 years old and was on hospice, was about to die, was lying in the one bedroom. So we went into the kitchen and we sat and we talked, and she told me about her life. But she had always had the thrust, but she wanted to develop a family, and out of the kindness of her heart, although she hardly has any money, she is raising her teenage sister, and that's pretty hard go. And she's going to go back to school at this point. She is going to start a little business, taking care of her sister, and she's taking care of her grandfather. The woman kind of knows no boundaries in terms of open heart. She says a little bit about what it means to her. It says, I have to make sure that I appreciate every moment, even though I'm living in a little room. Maybe we'll get a bigger place. I want a bigger place, but being happy in every moment you're alive is most important. We're not in need of anything, thankfully. We're eating, we have a car, can put gas in the car. To find a home, you have to be okay thinking, it's just me. Instead of wishing for parents, become one in the future. I'll be there for whoever needs me. But I have had enough of overextending myself. It's not good for me. I've been trying to find or make a home lots of times, but I've found it has to happen inside me. The only thing I can do is control me. I'm a spiritual person. I rely on a higher power, but I find that home is within myself. And I think if she could speak for almost everybody in this book, that would be the message.
Now, how did you find these people? Did they come to you?
Oh, boy. That was a journey, too. I did a lot of research on the internet, and then I just started calling centers, for example. In Washington, D.C., I went and saw a woman's day shelter and talked to women there. And sometimes it was just serendipity. I had a friend. I was living in Kansas City at the time. She came back from visiting San Diego, and she said, you know, there's this woman who has a B&B in San Diego, but she's doing something with
young people that I can't remember, but I think maybe you might be interested. So I said, well, I guess I can pin this down a little farther. The Native Americans, I just plain struck out on my own, except that I did have a guide at one point. It was a really interesting man who's helped the... That's the other thing, is I have some helping type people in here as well, the people who have given others a hand up. And this man had helped lots of Navajos who'd worked for the railroad and had the railroad to kind of screw them over, shall we say, when they were injured. And so he'd help them settle court cases and things. And he took me in to introduce me to some people. Yeah. And I met him in a motel room in where was it? Oklahoma somewhere, going from point A to point B, and I started talking to him. And he said, here, you should come see me. And he hands me this card and it says, "We sue railroads." Okay.
I'm sure that's not very clear. Could you be more specific?
Yeah. Then I just really pursued, lots of times I would go through agency, and it's really funny because you get there and I would have set up this appointment, for example, in New Orleans, and at a place that was helping kids who were coming out of prison, underage kids, and it was sort of their second home, but they didn't really live there, but the people were just so sympathetic and kind, they spent as much time as they could there. So I went to talk to the director. And this had been planned for about 4 months, and I had limited time in New Orleans. It's not the cheapest place to stay. And she said, oh, I don't have any time to talk to you, and I'm just super busy. And I guess I looked crestfallen. And she said, oh, but you can talk to August Collins. He's really a good resource. Well, here came this big, wonderful, generous man who had been through the same sort of background himself. And so he was most naturally suited to be helping these young people, and talked to me, and I mean, gave me a big bear hug after through. You had to just kind of let it go. You know what I mean? Just let's see what's happening here. This should be fine. And 9 times out of 10, that was the perfect person. That was the person I was supposed to talk to.
So when all is said and done with this book, how have you looked at your own life differently? Has your perspective been altered somewhat? I would imagine it could, there's no way it could not have been, but have you noticed anything consciously, decisions that you've made recently?
Yeah.
Because of conversations, not maybe specifically about their homes, but just conversations that people have shared.
Yes, almost everybody has helped me advance the notion that we're interconnected. Just when you think that you're at your lowest ebb and you have retreated into that place where you think, okay, well, this is where I'm going to live and there is no help, then something comes along or something happens or somebody enters your life who is the right person to be helping you along to the next step in your life. And it can be from the most unlikely source. So my eyes are really wide open to, and my ears are wide open, and my heart is wide open to seeing with each person I meet, what is our connection? What is this supposed to be about? And I try not to overthink it, because there's just a universe out there. And I've been doing yoga for years and using the word namaste. And finally, I said, oh, snap. This is it. Okay, I get this now.
Again, her book is Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. This Sunday is Mother's Day, and I wanted to give a shout out to the grandmothers. I was fortunate to know my grandparents throughout their lifetimes as they lived within driving distance. My maternal grandmother always dressed like a lady. Always, even when gardening. She'd kneel down on the dirt in her skirt and push the sleeves of her cashmere sweater up to her elbows so it wouldn't get dirty. She taught me card games like Crazy Eight, Solitaire, Kings in the Corner, and Spit, plus the games of I Spy and Button, Button, Who's Got the Button. And she made the best spaghetti sauce with pot roast juices. My paternal grandmother was more practical and wouldn't take much to set her off. Never walk into the kitchen with dirty shoes. Don't peel so much of the potato. I loved her, though. And I understood her better when I was an adult, after my father shared a story he didn't even know until he was an adult. Her mother left the family when my grandmother was just 16. A sheriff walked into her classroom and told her that she had to go home and take care of the other children. She was humiliated. Her father worked in the woods for a lumber mill and would be gone for days. Because she was now responsible for the other kids, her siblings, her father wouldn't let her go to college, even though she somehow amazingly kept her grades up or even get a job. When she married, she had to raise three boys. No wonder she got cranky so easily. I asked a gentleman at a wine bar to share a little something about his grandmothers.
My grandmother is the reason why I am in Winters.
Her name?
Grace Peterson, who would come to Winters and visit her great uncle, Charlie Chambers, who was a barber here in town. And she loved Winters, and she'd come up for summers, and she lived in Oakland and was born in Giles Valley, between here and Napa. And her uncle left her the house on Main Street here, the barber left her the house, and we would come up, I would come up as a child, and those were great memories of both my grandmother and grandfather for Youth Day or Easter, or we'd come up on the weekends for the summer. And that's how I came to Winters. She left the house to my father, and we were able to come here. And we lived here for 2 years while my son was born, so my wife wouldn't have to work. So she could spend those first 2 years with my son, Sam. It's funny how things come full circle. My great-great-great-uncle, being a barber here, just 100 yards from where we are in the stables. He cut hair here when he first came. And now I'm in one of the old packing sheds, which is 100 yards from where he had his chair, barber's chair. It's fun.
So tell me about your grandmother, though. What was her personality like?
Oh, she was fiery. She knew. She was sharper than she let on. And I think she really...
Yeah,
all women are. You know, men are just blind. She was wonderful, I think. She kept the family together, as a lot of them do, as my grandmother on my other side, my mother's side, who was one of 11. And that was keeping a lot of people together, and they both did. It's wonderful to see. And again, our parents don't have the same views of their parents as we do of our grandparents. Well, they're mutual enemies. That's why we have enemies in common. But I was fortunate to have both of my grandparents for a long time. I still have my grandfather. He's in West Sacramento. But women are strong, and it's fun to see that. I think we need to open our eyes and realize that both mothers, grandmothers, and women are strong individuals and do a lot more than they've given credit for. It's time we give women more credit.
So, don't forget your grandmothers this Sunday. Do something different. Write with a fountain pen.